Okay, let's get st I'm here. All right. Let's get started here. How about now? So this is the next discussion of introductions. I'm not going in any specific order. So if you're trying to figure out why I picked the Ramban next, I'm not sure. But I thought we would take up the Ramban's introduction to Bereishis. And what makes us different than what we did last time with Sajagon is that where Sajagon's writing an introduction to his book, the Ramban's obviously not writing an introduction to his book because the book's already been written by, well, we'll see who wrote it once we get through the Hakdama. Rather, he's writing an introduction to the commentary that he will be giving on the Torah itself. And he actually has a Hakdama, an introduction to every section of the Torah, meaning one for Shmos, one for Vayikra, etc. However, the one in Bereishis really lays out more in detail his plan insofar as his commentary. So a lot of the focus today will be on what makes the Ramban's commentary unique. And before he actually starts the introduction to Bereishis, he actually has an introductory poem that introduces his introduction. And that was a very, actually, you'll see a very common thing that Gaonim and Rishonim did was write a poem where they expressed certain ideas about what their goals were in the project they were undertaking. And that following that came the regular introduction itself. So a little background on the Ramban. I'm sure everyone here has heard of him. The Ramban was Moshe ben Nachman. He was born in 1194 and died in 1270. He spent most of his life in Catalonia, but of course, as everyone knows, he made his way to Eretz Yisrael. And many consider him to be the greatest of the Rishonim outside of the Rambam. That's certainly, as you'll see, based on the amount of works that he composed, there's certainly a compelling argument for that to be the case. I don't know who comes out with these rankings about what makes him the greatest of the Rishonim except for the Rambam, but that's what's commonly heard in the walls of the Beis Medrash, that after the Rambam, the Ramban comes in a close second. So when it comes to what he wrote, it's actually extremely extensive. Early on, he wrote works, for instance, defending the Rif against the Baal Maor. So the Baal Maor was a an ex brilliant, I would say today would probably not be accepted among mainstream Orthodox Judaism. But he was, from a Gemara standpoint, was a brilliant thinker who attacked the Rif in various issues. If you ever look in the back of a Gemara that has a Dape Rif in it, in certain Masechtas, you'll see on the bottom the Baal Maor. It's called the Maor HaKatan, Maor HaGadol. And the Ramban, every instance the Baal Maor writes, he usually attacks the Rif. The Ramban took it upon himself to write a Sefer called Milchames Hashem against the Baal Maor. So every time the Baal Maor attacks the Rif, the Ramban steps in just about every time in this Sefer called Milchames Hashem, which is a really cool name for Sefer, to go ahead and defend the Rif. I'm sure everyone's familiar with the Disputation of Barcelona, which is something that he actually wrote about afterwards. He wrote a very important commentary on Gemara that doesn't get enough attention, unfortunately. The Ramban's Peirush on Gemara is outstanding. The Rav referred to the Ramban as almost like a Brisker. He's a very clear writer when he writes in Gemara, and much of the Ritva and the Rashba often echoes the writings of the Ramban. So Ramban is a tremendous commentary on Gemara. He wrote works on Halacha. He wrote not just on Toras Adam, which we'll get to that in a second, but he wrote books on Halacha in areas about Sukkah, etc. He also wrote, as everyone knows, attacks on the Rambam and a Sefer Mitzvos. So his knowledge of Mitzvos and Halacha was extensive. Toras Adam is unique. I happen to be picking that one. Toras Adam is a Sefer that details all the Halachas starting from Bikur Cholim all the way through Misa and Avelis, and then it culminates with Olam Haba, which is in his Sefer of called Shaar Gemul, which I'm going to get to in a second. But the Ramban wrote a lot of stuff on Halacha. He wrote works in philosophy, i.e., Shaar Gemul. Shaar Gemul is very well known. The Ramban had an extremely interesting perspective on the world to come, and he wrote other works in philosophy as well. You could see a lot of his philosophy in the sermons that he gave, which is the next thing, where he, for instance, he gave a sermon about Koheles, You can get a real insight into his thinking. And of course, he wrote a commentary on Iyov. So his commentary on Nach was limited. And then finally, he wrote the commentary on Torah, which he did towards the end of his life. And that's what we're going to focus on today, his Akdama to his parish in Torah, which I think it's safe to say is probably the area that people are most familiar with the Ramban. Again, other than his being classified as arguing on the Rambam, I think his parish in Torah is probably most commonly known among Jews today. Okay, so his parish in Torah was written towards the end of his life. And if you go through, if you've read the Ramban, it's very, very fascinating how he writes. First of all, he's not the clearest of all writers. That's one important thing. Sometimes it's very, very difficult and challenging to get through a piece by the Ramban. And what the Ramban often does is that he'll challenge Rashi's opinion, the Ibn Ezra, not as often, but the Rambam, especially the Rambam from the Mor Devuchim, and very often Chazal. And that was something that's very shocking sometimes to people. When you read the Ramban will quote, and he'll say, Vidarshu, that Chazal darshan out, the Chazal learned out something, and then he'll openly reject it and give his own shot, which today might even seem sacrilegious, but the Ramban had no, repression whatsoever in being open about attacking what he considered to be not the simplest interpretation of what's going on in the Torah. And he also introduces the idea of coming up with thematic chapter structures. So a lot of his Torah, a lot of his Chidushim come about through seeing, let's say, an entire section of Psukim together rather than simply looking at one Pasuk on its own. So that's something else you see in a lot of the Ramban's works. And we'll see some more details through his Hakdama, how he wrote his parish on the Torah. Okay, so he starts off with a poem. This is a very, like I mentioned before, it's a very common technique in writing to start off with a poem. And there's no question, what's really cool about it is that they use the poem to go ahead and convey critical points they want to bring across. At the same time, you need a certain talent to write poetry, a certain literary talent. And it's clear the Ramban, the Ibn Ezra, and others who write this definitely have that. A good example of I would argue, while we've lost the appreciation of poetry today, are slichos. Slichos are really written in a poetic style. And since the language is very dense and very difficult for us to understand, those who don't speak Hebrew fluently, it becomes a challenge to appreciate the poetic structure. But poetry was a very, very common way of conveying information. And the other thing it does, which it's done so well by people, Chachamim wrote slichos, or here the Ramban, for example, is that in the stanzas of the poem, they tie in various psukim or allusions to things written in Gemara. So they'll take like four words from a pasuk, and then three of their own words and tie it together. And you need to have a pretty strong foundation in Tanakh and in Gemara to appreciate where these sources come from. And I'll show you an example in just in a second. Okay, but often these psukim are used to prove a certain point. So I'll give you an easy example. Okay, so the Ramban spends a decent amount of time in this poem trying to convey the humility, the anivus that he has in writing this commentary. I mean, who was he to go ahead and write a parish on Chumash? So what does he say? He says that he's asking forgiveness for going on this endeavor, and he writes with kneeling and with prostration until all the vertebrae of the spine need to be loosened. Okay, now, he didn't make that up himself. What he's alluding to is the Gemara Brachos. What the Gemara Brachos says is that when somebody bows down, when they're saying Shemona Esrei, they have to bow down to the point where the vertebrae of their spine are sticking out of their back. So the Ramban is picking, he's using a source from Gemara, weaving it into the poem to express his point. So that's something he does throughout this introductory poem. But we're not going to spend time on this stuff. Just if you do go through it on your own, recognize that that's a tactic he does. So let's get into the meat of what he really, really wants to talk about. Okay, so the Ramban, initially the Ramban presents a very, very fascinating tension that exists in anyone who takes upon themselves the task of trying to write a parish on Torah. Okay, so on the one hand, the way he describes the Torah is that, and this is a critical point in the Ramban's approach to Torah itself, he says everything, every profound mystery, all chachma, everything is stored within the Torah, okay? And you'll see why that's such a critical point later on in the Hakdama. But the Ramban emphasizes that that's an essential idea of Torah, that everything can be found inside the Torah. So if that's true, right? We'll get to this idea of how every hint or word holds these extremely vast and deep secrets. If that's true, so then the question that comes up is, how could he possibly write a parish on this? Meaning, if everything is to, if every idea and concept is found within Torah, so then how could you possibly write a parish on Torah? It'd be an absurd, it would be an absurd task for someone to take upon themselves. Again, to say that every single part of Torah has in it all sorts of chachma, wisdom, infinite, countless, etc. Every word has, every word, even the way the words are written, has a hint to some type of idea. So then how could someone write a parish on the Torah? So what's his answer? What's the other side of the tension? He says he just can't stop himself. He says, "Aval ma e'ese." He's like, what can I do? He says, on the other hand, I crave for Torah. And his entire existence is one that just wants to be engaged in Torah all the time. So he justifies his ability to write a parish on Torah based on the fact that he's somebody who just loves it. His just incredible love of Torah is why he feels it necessary to write a parish on Torah itself. Now, this is very different, okay, than, for instance, what we saw last time by Sajagon. Sajagon's writing a sefer, right, as a response to a potential problem. And he spends the entire Hakdama really reviewing a lot of the problems that existed in his period of time and why Emunos Vedeos is a reaction to that. But that's not what the Ramban's doing, for the most part. He does mention a little bit at the end of the Hakdama. But in general, the Ramban's saying, why is he writing a parish on Torah? Because he wants to. He thinks it's really great. He loves Torah, and he feels he should do it, even though he recognizes that writing a parish on Torah would almost seem to be a task that's impossible to ever achieve. So he's very honest in appreciating this tension. He definitely, in my opinion, gets points for honesty as well as humility in recognizing this idea. Okay, and he says openly that in his commentary, he's following in the steps of those greater than him. He recognizes that, and that's a big idea in the Ramban. Even though the Ramban challenges Rashi and Ibn Ezra and Chazal, he also has a tremendous amount of respect for those who are greater than him. He's a big fan of precedent. It's a big misconception people have of the Ramban's attitude towards, for instance, the Rambam, and you'll see the Ibn Ezra and others, which is that by virtue of him attacking them, you must think that he must inherently disagree and think of them as being terrible. But the Ramban spends so much time in poems defending those people. When he writes the Sefer against the Baal Mor, he writes how the Baal Mor is an incredible Talmud Chacham. So sometimes you can argue that's lacking in our, I'd say, intellectual discourse today. But the Ramban clearly, maintained a tremendous amount of respect for those who preceded him. Okay, and who are the people greater than him? And this is important. He says the people greater than him are people who offered explanations of psukim, midrashic interpretations, as well as agada. So he's clearly pointing towards Chazal first and foremost. Okay, as those who really, in many ways, accomplished these various objectives. We're able to darshan up psukim, right? Give interpretations, pshatim based on midrashim and agadah as well. And you definitely see that in the Gemara. But now he does something fascinating. Okay, he says, okay, but he can't go in this alone. Meaning the Ramban never said to himself, I'm going to go ahead and write a parish on Torah just relying on my own intuition. Rather, what he says is that he wants a guide. He wants someone to be his guide as he writes his parish. So who is that person? That person is Rashi. And he really layers on the praise of Rashi. Okay, he says Rashi will illuminate the way. He says about Rashi, in his words, will I meditate, and their love will I ravish. I mean, this is tremendously strong language. And with them, we will have discussions, investigations, and examinations. Now, what's very interesting about that is that the Ramban is clearly indicating that Rashi's words are not just meant to be read literally, but that there is depth to what Rashi writes as well. Often Rashi is sometimes read in a way where we just read him through and we don't think into what he's saying. The Ramban clearly saw Rashi as being someone of tremendous intellectual depth, not just someone who had all this information in front of him and was able to organize it well, but also someone who had a lot of depth. All right, and as anyone who reads Ramban's commentary knows, he attacks Rashi viciously, okay? And he writes, but as I mentioned before, he also writes of his tremendous respect of those he's about to trash. So to Rashi's credit, to Ramban's credit, rather than just trash Rashi, he'll demonstrate that no, he really respects Rashi, and the only reason why he would take the time to trash him is because he respected him. If he was a nobody, He would never do such a thing. So the Ramban wants to emphasize the fact that when it comes to attacking Rashi, don't take it personally, okay? And like I mentioned before, also in having discussions with Rashi, right, he's trying to decipher what Rashi's saying. Rashi's not simply about reading what he wrote about X, but rather there's always a reason why. For instance, one thing Rashi does tremendously well is that he'll select which medrash is appropriate for this specific pasuk. So what the Ramban is saying is that there's a reason for that. And the Ramban, even though he'll attack Rashi, he'll try to understand Rashi's rationale first and foremost and offer defense of it if it's possible. Okay, that's a very important point. Yes, go ahead. Viewed Rashi in a very, very unique way, which we'll discuss right now, as compared to Ibn Ezra. So let me just make this one more point, and then we'll take a step back and discuss this, because this is a natural stopping point. So the Ramban throws in, after he spends about like 10 lines of this poem, really, really praising Rashi. I mean, how Rashi's the best, okay? But he also mentions the Ibn Ezra, and this is something that has raised the curiosity of so many people who've read the Ramban's Hakdama to try to understand what's he talking about here. He says, when it comes to the Ibn Ezra, okay, he says as follows, with Avram the son of Ezra, we will have open rebuke and hidden love. And that's it. This line right here is the only thing he says about the Ibn Ezra, okay? Now recall, the Ibn Ezra also, in other words, he died, the Ramban's right after him, okay? But why does the Ramban not quite give the same degree of praise, right, that he gave to Rashi, okay? Again, notice he says openly he's going to attack the Ibn Ezra, but at the same time, he has love for him, meaning that he recognized that Ibn Ezra was an important commentary. But I think what you could say, is that what makes Rashi so different than Ibn Ezra is I think the Ramban saw Rashi as the natural evolution of a Chazal type of commentary. Because what does Rashi do? Rashi acts like Chazal. Rashi goes ahead and darshans out. Again, he is playing with Chazal's words, but Rashi, in many ways, I would say, mimics and emulates the way Chazal interpret things. But the Ibn Ezra doesn't. And recall, by the way, that the Ramban, as you'll see soon, is a big, big proponent of the idea that the entire Torah was given to Moshe at Sinai. Everything. Okay? Whereas we know the Ibn Ezra famously challenges that idea by the last eight psukim, which, again, there's a sheet in the Gemara that goes that way. The Ramban vehemently rejected that, and there were those who looked at the Ibn Ezra as being someone who was outside the mainstream. But the Ibn Ezra was a much different, not only was it a much different kind of commentary, he was a much different kind of figure. For example, even though the Ibn Ezra is in every Chumash, there is no Perush of the Ibn Ezra on Gemara. But Rashi's got that. Right, there's no there's really no works of the. I mean, the Ibn Ezra did write on philosophy, right? But we're not talking about major works of philosophy. He has a couple things here or there, but overall, the Ibn Ezra, I'd say, insofar as his status, he was a tremendous grammarian. He was a brilliant person when it came to knowledge of grammar and diktuk. He wrote his Perush on Chumash, but he wasn't as accomplished of a person in the scheme of someone's resume as Rashi. Rashi really fits that model of the person who's able to use a gadata and measures and stuff like that. The Ibn Ezra doesn't write that way. The Ibn Ezra is a much different kind of commentary. And I think that's the reason why the Ramban recognizes his tremendous contribution he made in his parish in Torah, but it's clear he does not see him as being on the same plane as Rashi. Rashi's somebody who really is like the next stage in the development of Chazal. The Ibn Ezra is like a brilliant thinker, but definitely more of a radical. So I think the Ramban recognizes that, where he says he's going to attack the Ibn Ezra because he sees the Ibn Ezra's commentary often as being too much of a challenge against the traditional way of learning. But at the same time, he has a tremendous amount of respect for him, but not the same kind of respect he has for Rashi. And I think that's evident in the way he structures the poem. The Ibn Ezra gets one little line, whereas Rashi gets a tremendous amount of attention. And these are the points I just made. Whereas we don't really know how the Ramban saw the Ibn Ezra, okay? He must have been aware of, obviously, of the Ibn Ezra's more controversial positions, but doesn't take him to task for that. Usually his attacks on the Ibn Ezra, often the Ramban, what he'll do is he'll quote Rashi and say, I don't agree with that. He'll quote the Ibn Ezra and say, I don't agree with that, and then go into his own shot. He's not really vicious when it comes to his attacks on the Ibn Ezra, and the fact that he includes him in the Hakdama shows he obviously takes the Ibn Ezra very, very seriously. Okay, so he ends off with the poem by saying, God, please give me guidance. And that ends the poem, and now begins the actual Hakdama to Sefer Bereishis. So again, the poem is like the Hakdama to the Hakdama. So now the Ramban starts off with his Hakdama to Sefer Bereishis, okay? So he starts off with a very strong assertion, and it makes a lot of sense why he starts off this way. He says, Moshe Rabbeinu wrote the entire Sefer Torah, okay? The entire book of Bereishis, okay, along with the entire Torah, receiving it from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, I ask, why would the Ramban start off? I mean, again, this is his Hakdama to Sefer Bereishis. Why does he start off with this statement of all the things he could start off with? Why emphasize the fact that Moshe wrote both Sefer Bereishis along with the rest of the Torah from God? Because we know Bereishis doesn't fit in to the narrative. I mean, this, again, it's an allusion, so to speak, to Rashi's famous question, why start off with creation? But if you look at the style, the structure of Chamisha Chumshei Torah, there's no question that Bereishis doesn't really fit in. I mean, the stories are great, right? But insofar as where should the Torah have started, in other words, from the Ramban standpoint, where should the Torah have started? It should have started with Moshe's birth. There's, in the Ramban's eyes, as you'll see, in the Ramban's eyes, Moshe is really the one that should have been, the birth of Moshe should have been the beginning of the Torah. But he has to emphasize to show that there's a homogeneous nature to the Torah, that Bereishis is just as much a part of the Torah as any other sefer. So Ramban lays out immediately. He has no tolerance for any documentary hypothesis. The Ramban maintains right off the bat, Moshe wrote everything, including Sefer Bereishis, and all came from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay? And like I said, he's very bothered that it could be otherwise. Okay? Now, what are the two possibilities for how Moshe did this? So either Moshe got Sefer Bereishis on Har Sinai, right? So when he went up to get the Luchos, so when God spoke to Moshe, he started off with Sefer Bereishis, giving him this information, or Moshe wrote it when he wrote the entire Torah during its 40th year. And the Ramban's not sure about that. And again, that's in Parshas Vayelech, where according to many Shitas, that meant that that Moshe was writing down the Sefer Torah then. The Ramban's not sure at what point Moshe wrote down Sefer Bereishis. Was it at Har Sinai, or was it at the point where he actually wrote the entire Torah down the 40th year? If it wasn't at Har Sinai, that means that there was a long period of time where Sefer Bereishis was not among the written works that Bnei Yisrael had access to, and it wasn't only until the 40th year that Moshe Rabbeinu would have written it down. But either way, no matter what you say, Sefer Bereishis is part of the entire Torah, and it should be looked at differently. But again, so he asked the question. So if that's true, if Sefer Bereishis is part of the Torah, so why, and what's Moshe doing? Moshe is writing down what God tells him, then the first pasuk of the Torah should have been, Vayidaber Hashem Moshe Lemor. Bereishis bara Elokim esesh mayim vezaretz. Okay? It's a phenomenal question. And that's what's brilliant about the Ramban. In this Hakdama, he builds, and it's very, very interesting logical style, how he asks these questions and builds his argument, but this is a very, very reasonable question. Why did the Torah begin with Vayidaber Hashem El Moshe Lemor? That seems to be the most obvious way to start off the Torah to demonstrate that God told Moshe the entire Torah. I mean, it's such a powerful question. So what does he say? So first, he tries to demonstrate that the Torah lacks any first-person perspective. When you read through the Torah, you don't see a first-person perspective. You always see a third person. You see talking about Avram, talking about Yitzchak, talking about Moshe, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe lemor, Daber el Bnei Yisrael. You always see things in the third person, not in the first person perspective. But one second, I know anyone who's still paying attention is going to say, what about Sefer Dvarim? Doesn't Moshe write in the first person? Yes, there's plenty of times in Sefer Dvarim that he does that. And so the Ramban obviously was aware of that. So the Ramban's very shrewd. He says that Moshe is not writing about, you know, he's not saying, I did this. Moshe's writing about himself. So it's like Moshe writing about, it's like a third person to first person type of writing. It's not that Moshe is writing personally. He's writing about himself in Sefer Dvarim. So even though Sefer Dvarim comes off like it's first person, the Ramban would still maintain that's a type of third person. It's a tricky maneuver he's trying to pull off, but that's how he explains how the Torah is consistently third person. Okay, so when you see Moshe writing about himself, right, he's writing about himself, rather writing from a first-person standpoint. That's how, according to the Ramban, you should read Sefer Dvarim when you see Moshe saying Va'anochi and things of that nature. Okay? Now, if that's the case, okay, so now the Ramban goes to the next question. Why was the Torah written in the third person? Okay? Why did it have to be that way? Okay, why write in the third person? So Ramban explains, and cryptically, the Torah preceded the creation of the world, and it preceded the birth of Moshe himself. So since the Torah began in such a way, okay, the entire Torah now takes on the character of being transcribed. And that's the key thing. Moshe now, what's Moshe's role? Moshe's role now was to transcribe everything. In other words, this information, so to speak, the Torah itself pre-existed the universe. All the information in the Torah is already there. So all we could ever do is just, all Moshe could ever do is take the information God gives him and write it down on a piece of paper, okay? Or on a piece of parchment in this case. But if that's true, okay, what does that do? So then Moshe, okay, all Moshe's doing is he's just bringing about this objective. So Moshe at this point is a glorified stenographer. I mean, think about that. The Ramban has no choice right now, and now he's going to make this huge step forward because of this problem. Moshe's role is simply a stenographer, right? Moshe didn't have to be this great Navi. Remember, if you recall, the Rambam spends a lot of time in explaining why Moshe's status as a Navi was so critical to him being the Shaliach. According to the Ramban, at this point, all Moshe is doing is he's just taking this body of information that God has and putting it down on a piece of parchment. That's his job. Anyone could do it. Anyone could do such a thing. There's nothing unique to Moshe. So this would shatter our entire vision of Moshe being this incredible person. He could have been anybody. Anybody could have done the job of being a stenographer of God's information. And that's an extremely important problem. All right. So how does Ramban wiggle his way out of that problem? So now he takes the next step forward, which is a very, very fascinating, some would argue radical idea in how he understood Moshe. And when I put down traditional, what I mean by traditional is he needs to put Moshe back underneath the spotlight of being like the greatest human being alive. So how does he do that? How does he elevate Moshe from being a glorified stenographer to being the Moshe Rabbeinu that we all were taught about in school and the way the Gemara presents him? So what he says is that God taught Moshe everything, okay? And I capitalize that for a reason. He literally taught Moshe all knowledge, okay? So what that did is that now Moshe is not just simply anybody, but now he's the smartest person alive because he knows everything. So what God chose to do was God chose to elevate Moshe's status by making him the greatest student he ever had. That's Moshe's role, okay? And as you'll see in a second, according to Ramban, it means every single possible piece of information Moshe knew, okay? So what was Moshe's curriculum? So one thing is the creation of the metaphysical, okay? Meaning things like malachim and the spheres and all the things, the forces that were brought into existence when the universe was created. That's one course he took. Another course was the creation of the physical world. He taught Moshe exactly how the universe came into existence, as well as he taught Moshe how the physical world was run. Now, this is where the Ramban stops, okay? Okay, now remember, in the running of the physical world, that would include things like biology and chemistry. I'm using modern-day terms. Creation of the physical world would be cosmology and physics. Creation of metaphysical, metaphysics. Okay, but only insofar as the creation is concerned. What's fascinating is the Ramban never mentions anything like teaching Moshe things like ethics and morals, meaning the Ramban sees the ultimate level of knowledge, and it does hint to how the Rambam looks at things as well. According to the Ramban, Moshe's complete knowledge, right, was ben adam l'makom, meaning it was humanity's relationship to the universe and therefore his relationship to God. It wasn't in things like how best to behave among your fellow men. That was not something that was included, according to the Ramban, in Moshe's curriculum. His knowledge of everything meant what we would call like higher knowledge, knowledge of how physics works and how chemistry works and biology. Moshe knew everything. And the Ramban's insistent upon that. That's like one of the foundations of his entire theory of Moshe, is that Moshe was the ultimate Talmud, but he keeps the focus of Moshe's curriculum very narrow. That what did Moshe learn? Moshe's knowledge, I'm going to say this carefully, was limited to these areas. But things like ethics and morals, bad news for people like fiction. Moshe was not reading books about literature. He wasn't reading poetry. He wasn't reading any of that stuff. These are the things that he was focused on. It's a great question. But for now, this is what he maintains Moshe's curriculum was, okay? But I think your question is an excellent question. There's got to be more than that, right? There has to be more than that. Okay, so... Right. Okay, good. So let's see how that works, okay? So the now in other words, now comes his major move now, which is where now that he's taken Moshe and demonstrated that Moshe was the ultimate student and that Moshe knew everything, okay? Now, the next thing the Ramban does is that, and this is the hardest thing to understand in what he maintains, and I've heard many people take this idea, I won't say out of context, but to a very bizarre conclusion. The Ramban says that everything that was taught to Moshe can be found in the Torah. Okay, so to set us up mathematically, okay, if Moshe knew everything, okay, meaning all knowledge was given to Moshe, right? The Ramban's saying that same equation of all knowledge is also found in the Torah itself. So nothing that Moshe learned is everything that Moshe learned can be found in the Torah as well. Every single thing. Ah, but what you're going to tell me? One second. We have a very cryptic story of Bereishis, of creation, right? There's really not much, if any at all, about how physics works or biology, right? So what is he talking about, right? And then we get to the question you raise: what about all these specific things? How is that possible? Okay. So first he goes on this idea about what are called the 50 gates of understanding, and he explains that 49 of them were taught to Moshe. So again, in this idea of gates of understanding, he's saying, again, with those gates, by the way, they're mostly physics and metaphysics. There's one other one, which we'll get to in a second, which is more bizarre, right? He says 49 of them were taught to Moshe. That demonstrates how smart Moshe was. And as an aside, he explains that as you rise in these levels of gates, the gates are a hierarchy, okay? As you go up and up and up, okay, and you come closer to the area of metaphysics, he says, what must you do? And I'm not going to get too much into this. He says, you must master sorcery or witchcraft. Or if you want to put in a more rational bend, unexplainable forces that exist in the universe. Meaning that according to the Ramban, that in order to get to the point of metaphysics, the last point right before metaphysics is knowledge of sorcery and magic. Those are things that the Ramban maintained are necessary to get to that level. Now, that's not important to understand the Hakdama. It's just interesting that he does mention that, okay? But now, again, he's emphasizing that Moshe Rabbeinu went through all these levels of understanding, okay? Again, layer by layer, layer by layer. Now, what's the key point? Okay, everything taught to Moshe, which means the entirety of the knowledge of metaphysics and physics, can be found in the Torah. You can find all scientific information can be found in a Torah, okay? Now, here's the problem, though. Either you'll see it outright in the Pesukim, okay, or somehow it's implied from the words, okay, or gematria, or the forms of the letters, and even the tagin. The tagin are the little tiny crowns that are on top of the letters, okay? So this sounds great on the surface, okay? What the Ramban is trying to say, I mean, again, now you can see how things are, in a sense, coming together. The Ramban's trying to say is that when he says that all knowledge is contained in the Torah, that doesn't mean if I read a pasuk, right, I can all of a sudden understand everything about metaphysics. But what he's saying is that there's hints and secrets and gematrias and things like the forms of the letters, where there was a special tradition and how to understand what they meant. You can arrive to any conclusion about the universe through the Torah itself. So just as an example of the extreme version of this that I heard someone say one time, that it's not that Einstein came up with the theory of relativity, but you could use the Torah to come up with that same theory as well. Okay, I don't think the Ramban would agree with that, but I understand why someone would think the Ramban would say that, because what Ramban is saying is that there is no such thing as any information that exists in the universe that could, or in metaphysics, that could not be derived from the Torah itself. That's a very, very important and different way of looking at the Torah. The Rambam definitely did not look at the Torah in such a way. That doesn't mean it wasn't filled with, countless wisdom, but certainly to say that all information is contained in the Torah, that's something the Rambam would not agree with. But the Ramban held that certainly was the case. So when we say everything was taught to Moshe, now everything comes together. Moshe knew everything, right? And the same way but Moshe actually knew everything outright. All that information that Moshe knew was also put into the Torah, but wasn't put into the Torah in an obvious way. There's mesoros you must have, and Kabbalah you must know, and methods of extracting information. But in theory, right, if a person wanted to understand, let's say, something in biochemistry, right, you could somehow, according to Ramban, you could somehow derive that from the Torah itself. All knowledge, according to Ramban, exists in the Torah. Everything. So it's a very, very difficult idea. Especially because when we read the Torah today, I don't think people see it that way. Or I don't think most people see it that way. But that's what the Ramban held. And he was adamant about that point. Okay? Absolutely. You do not need the Gemara. You could therefore use the Torah to get to the point of Gemara. 100%. Anything. I'm just emphasizing secular stuff because to me that's even more shocking, you know? But I mean, let's say like, the current standard must, for sure, but the current standard model of physics, you could use the Torah to get to that conclusion. Now, some want to argue, there's another theory that what the Ramban was saying was, he didn't really, I mean, even though he writes it as if everything in the Torah can lead to that, he didn't really, quote unquote, mean that. Rather, he's talking about the methodology of learning Torah, meaning the way we learn Torah is the same way. Whereas if you follow that methodology, you'll be able to uncover deep ideas about the universe, okay? You could say that, but he doesn't say that. Like, just an example, there's something called the Sefer Tagin, which has in it the number of times that the crowns are used on top of the letters, okay? The Ramban maintained that the essence and meanings of these Tagin is considered to be opening up a whole world of secrets, meaning if you understood why there's a crown here, 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 and here, bam, you have this entire area of knowledge you didn't know before is open up to you. Now, this is definitely an early indication of what they call the mystical leanings of the Ramban, because he's talking about areas of information that are not knowable to the senses, okay, and certainly not knowable to rational speculation, as Sad Shigon talks about. Sad Shigon would never talk about this. Sad Shigon had no concept of an idea of what it called of anything other than rational speculation. Mystical leanings, right, implies that there's these hidden ideas, things that are, you know, that you would never be able to intuit that lead to these types of conclusions. It's a very different world the Ramban has when he sees the Torah. Now, who does he turn to as the paradigm of this type of approach? Shlomo HaMelech. He dedicates about 2 pages or a page and a half of the Hakdama just about Shlomo. Shlomo was the greatest genius. We all know through our Masorah that Shlomo was at the highest possible level of being a Chacham. But what's interesting is that, and by the way, again, where did he derive it all from? From the Torah. And remember, Shlomo knew everything about medicine and biology and astronomy, right? I mean, talking to animals, all that stuff. He got it from the Torah, okay? And of course, the Ramban includes magic and sorcery. Meaning, again, through the Torah itself, if you maintain magic and sorcery exist, and you could also derive that from the Torah. So what made Shlomo so smart? He was able to look into the Torah and derive all his information from it. So in the Ramban's view of things, Shlomo didn't go to Harvard, right? Shlomo opened up the Sefer Torah and was just able to sit there and, I'm not sure how, but really access this deep information, which made him this genius. So Shlomo's genius came from his ability to derive the information from the Torah. How? That's a great question. Not sure how, but somehow he was able to do that. And that's what made Shlomo such a unique individual. Okay, so again, the question always becomes, how far can we go with this approach? How far can we take the idea of the Ramban of looking into the Torah and finding all information? All right, now, the Ramban senses this problem. He does sense this. And that's why he does, again, the last point he makes about this is that he relies on something that's found in the Zohar, which has to do with the idea of the Torah containing the names of God. That there's a way to rearrange the letters of the Torah, and in certain ways, you can always get various names of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, okay? Dividing and rearranging those letters. Meaning that the point is, what's the Ramban saying? That God, who is the source of all knowledge, is actually found in the Torah. Of course, it doesn't mean physically found in the Torah, but the idea that this type of Zohar concept is bringing across is that since God's the source of all knowledge, you can find that in the Torah as well. So that's his ultimate raya that this is the case. So again, if we go back to building his case, he went, and it's very clever, step by step. He goes from Moshe, the Torah being written in third person, to the idea of Moshe not being a stenographer. How so? He was the most brilliant person. What made him brilliant? He was taught everything. And all knowledge that Moshe had is the same all knowledge that exists in the Torah. He uses Shlomo as his raya and God and God's names as a proof as well. So finally, the Ramban ends, okay, and this is the last point. The Ramban ends by saying that, and this is a very important point, the Ramban says that in his writing, in his commentary, there's going to be stuff that people will just not understand. Anyone who's read Rambans before, especially the longer ones, will know the Ramban often has things like Sod or Hamavin Yavin, things of that nature. That's almost an indication that we have no idea what the Ramban's talking about. In fact, Art Scroll, in their translation of the Ramban, anytime the Ramban alludes to Kabbalah, they don't even translate that into English. They literally treat it as a secret to the point where they won't translate it. So the Ramban acknowledges that. The Ramban acknowledges that his commentary isn't meant to be understood by everybody. It's not even a question. Some parts of it, for sure. Other parts are just way too deep, too mysterious for the average person to ever understand. And he even says that to try and speculate on some of those more cryptic areas of what he writes will be a complete waste of time. So the Ramban sets us up. The Rambam does this as well. We'll do the Hakdamah to the Bor Nevuchim at some point. The Rambam does the same thing, where when they write these introductions, they tell you ahead of time, don't think you'll understand everything they're writing in their book. And the Ramban makes that clear here, that in his Parash and Chumash, don't think that you'll understand everything he's talking about. Quite often, and I've seen this before when I go through Rambans, quite often he'll make a point and he'll say, you know, I'm being cryptic, you don't understand what I'm saying, it's a secret, and that's it. And the Ramban's mindset, you shouldn't even bother speculating on such a thing. Of course, the tension, or I'd say even the, I won't call it a stira, but the tension is that it's like an ironic thing that the Ramban is telling us that all information can be found in the Torah, but he kind of blocks us off from trying to access that information, because he acknowledges himself that the stuff that he's giving over, you won't be able to understand. So it's like we're supposed to know that the Torah contains all knowledge information, but it doesn't mean any of us should think we can access that information. It's like a funny type of knowledge to know. Like, I know the Torah contains all this important stuff, but that doesn't mean I'll ever know this type of information. So I'm pretty sure that if I read through the Torah, I would not come to the next great discovery in particle physics. But there are those who maintain, the Ramban would say, that such a thing is possible.